Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Mike Duncan, BBC News, East London.
The morning after the night before, and the people are left with a big political hangover. Derek Beacon took the Tower Hamlets seat for the British National Party, the first time an extreme right-wing party had taken a council seat in Britain since the 1970s.
The British people are no longer prepared to be treated as second-class citizens in their own country. The British people have had enough. We are going to take our country back.
Today there is still confusion over what Derek Beacon stands for.
How can blacks and Asians sleep secure in their homes knowing that you're advocating a policy of compulsory repatriation?
Well, they can sleep perfectly safely because, you know, all we're advocating is stopping immigration into the country and starting repatriation of the Asians that are already here, only back to their own countries. You know, surely they'd be happier in their own countries than here.
But aren't these...
You know, obviously we don't get on with them, they don't get on with us.
Aren't your policies, though, encouraging thugs to simply take it out on the black and Asian community? It's legitimising racism.
No, I don't think it is. We're standing as candidates. We want the people to vote. We oppose all sorts of violence and attacks against whites also, which you don't hear much about in the media.
Do you think your presence here, though, is encouraging the mindless minority of thugs to take violent action against blacks and Asians?
No. I mean, Asians rioted on Friday night, so they're attacking whites. And so we're saying the multiracial site doesn't work, and repatriation is the only humane answer to it.
It took us about 8 years to get an earth, and if you're a Bangladesh, it takes you about a week. They're taking all the schools over and all the houses over. I mean, as I said, I've waited 8 years for a place. It's not fair, is it? And if you've waited that long and you've argued with people for 8 years and same with hospitals and schools, in the end, it gets on your nerves.
I voted for the British National Party. I did vote for them, yes, because I believe in them. We've got to do something to stand up for ourselves, and they're the only people to help us. Fair enough?
I've got nothing against the immigrants, but you cannot keep bringing immigrants onto a small place like this with no schooling, no housing, and nothing to accommodate the people what have lived here all their life, growing up to and going to.
I mean, we've lived through the war. We know what the Nazi Party is, don't we?
But you voted for them?
No, they're not. I don't think they are the Nazi Party.
On the left, the Anti-Nazi League blames the existing council's leaders for letting in the BNP. Meanwhile, Labour accused the Liberal Democrats of playing a dangerous game with the race issue during the election.
Well, clearly there's a lot more to be said, and we're going to get plenty more of reaction like that throughout the day. But however the main political parties blame one another, the BNP is going to turn around and say, we won, and that surely is the will of...
Welcome to Voice of Albion. John Tyndall, Part 12, on the White Network. First you heard a news clip shown on TV in 1993. The BNP candidate, Derek Beacon, had come first place in the London by-election at a local level and made history by becoming the first BNP councillor. The sound quality was poor as it's from a VHS upload. Back in 1993, I was 13 years old and didn't even know of the victory. In those days, the Marxist and self-hating white liberals denied that local councils were putting Asians to the front of the housing queue and used to say it was a myth. Just like some years later, they said, Muslim rape gangs was a myth, invented by the evil BNP to stir up racial hatred. These days, they like to stay away from such issues, as nationalists have forced MSN to report on them by relentless campaigning. One thing to bear in mind is that the BNP, as the newsreader said, campaigned heavily on the local issue of housing. Undoubtedly, it was this truth which swayed the close victory. Something to bear in mind for those who want to continually talk of race and nothing else. White genocide and the racial struggle are, of course, the core issue, and straying away from this loses support, as the modern BNP has found out. Sadly, the BNP will certainly lose its last two or three councillors this May. Nick Griffin's strategy of watering down the message and inviting Jews into the party has ruined a once successful nationalist organisation. Note, John Tyndall was party leader in 1993 when Derek Beacon got elected. On to chapter 14 of The 11th Hour by John Tyndall, A New Land and People. JT writes, In the late 1950s and early 1960s, I took 3 holidays on the European continent in which I attempted to see as many countries as possible, each holiday being condensed into the space of a fortnight. On my return, as I vividly remember, I always had the same impression. This was of the shabbiness and seediness of much of Britain by comparison with the places where I had just been. The contrast was most noticeable in the cities and larger towns. My memory of the return journeys is of a dilapidated railway stations staffed by scruffy-looking porters, of ugly and badly planned town centres and squalid suburbs, all noticeable for an abundance of dirt and litter, of large numbers of unhealthy-looking people whose faces, bearing an attire, showed little signs of personal pride. It had all the aspects of a concern that was under bad management, thoroughly run down, and where no one seemed to care. JT points out that this is a generalisation. There were, and are, many places that are the exception to the rule. He lists York, Bath, Oxford, Norwich, Edinburgh and Aberdeen, which have some very fine views and are a delight to visit. Excuse me. And a quick note there. The Marxist and liberal establishment are ruining the remaining pleasant places in England by building public houses, housing projects near pretty English places and putting in muds. Last year we was leafleting in an affluent town called Bromsgrove. We took a turn down one new housing development and were surprised to see gangs of blacks hanging around and multicoloured kids everywhere. My friend, who actually lives in Bromsgrove, was very shocked. We turned back and didn't leaflet the new estate. JT then talks about the appalling anarchy in urban design that has resulted in a disfigurement of so many of our towns and cities today. He compares them to the magnificent cities on the continent, with their spaciousness, symmetry, and overwhelming impression of civic pride and planning, which in almost all cases, JT asserts, being the product of a political tradition in which strong public authority has prevailed over commercial forces dedicated only to utility and profit. In Britain's town and city councils, have everywhere formed an unholy alliance with the developers in the mutilation of the urban landscape. The calibre of individual that now sits on these local bodies make this hardly surprising. Quite apart from the factor of bribery and corruption in the never-ending party political game. The party in current control of a council is constantly cocking its eye to the next round of local government elections, and in this regard is looking for ways to finance its own vote, catching schemes without too much increase in council taxes. Householders, big office, shop and department store developments, together with multi-storey car parks right in the centre of town, bringing much revenue. To councillors not in the first place imbued with much in the way of civic pride or local tradition, this is a tempting prospect and one to which, on present evidence, there is little resistance. JT states that local government in Britain must be removed from the marketplace, where it is just another business bent on making profits, and made subject to a firm national authority which obliges it to serve the community in the way it should. A quick note on that. A few years back it came to light that local councils had been investing in Icelandic banks. It came out when in 2009 the Audit Commission found that 7 English authorities breached official guidance and their own treasury management protocols in continuing to invest in Iceland after the bank's credit ratings were downgraded. The Commission found that authorities halved their investments in Icelandic banks during the course of 2008 for more than £2 billion. So that's local councillors gambling with taxpayers' money. JT writes of the environmentalists. While there's much in the way of good intentions in the environmentalist lobby, they are approaching the problem from the wrong angle. On the environmentalist, JT continues, education and lobbying are not alone sufficient to accomplish the task. There must be backed up by a strong element of national discipline that today is entirely lacking in this country and which is only going to come through radical political change of a nature which I suspect most environmentalists, conservationists and ecologists would be loath at this stage to accept. And there is one more vital respect in which the environmentalists are lacking in an answer to the problems to which they devote so much ink and talk. They speak of conserving the quality of this and the quantity of that, but never a word is heard from them about the most important conservation of all, which is that of the British people, both their quality and quantity, but especially the former. At the end of the day, even if, and this is a big if, we create the right political conditions and attitudes for the attainment of a foreign country to live in, our ability to achieve this depends most of all on the type of people we produce, not only in respect of their upbringing, education and training, but on the biological inheritance of intelligence, character and physical health with which they are born in the first place. JT goes on, "It is an astonishing anomaly that in a society in which we acknowledge the need for selective breeding of almost every living species in order to improve the quality of the type, we are totally indifferent to these breeding ideas when it comes to the most important species of all, and the one which we most depend for raising of the quality of everything, man himself. Among those who determine what is sometimes called public policy in Britain are farmers, racehorse owners, dog breeders, gardeners and horticulturalists, all of whom recognise as an elementary truth of life the importance of race quality, of the need to nurture the seeding of the best. But those same people would in all likelihood raise their heads in horror at the proposition that such rules should be applied to the human species, stigmatising it as racism, in quotes. They seem not to recognise that if racism were not applied in the prospect of food production, for instance, the community would soon starve. Obviously, this is not to suggest that human beings could or should be subject to the same clinical process of arbitrary selection as members of the animal and plant world. But what it does suggest is that we should preserve our country for those people of British and related European stocks who gave it its identity, character, and high level of human achievement, so that these, by natural individual choice, would marry among our native stocks, the highest birth rates on the part of the best, endowed and accomplished." Conservation, JT states, is nothing more than a meaningless piece of verbiage unless it includes this principle, and indeed starts with it. In recent times, the nation has been horrified by the dramatic rise in the crime rate, and especially in certain particularly brutal crimes involving children, child rape and murder, which indicate and which can only be described as subhuman. We hear frequently from those on the right of politics about the need for a greater element of deterrence to be introduced into our penal code and practice to combat this phenomenon, and I do not by any means disagree with this prescription. In fact, when we think that the British taxpayer is obliged to keep such creatures as the Yorkshire Ripper, the Stockwell Strangler, and the Moors murderers, Ian Brady and Maura Hindley, in food, warmth and clothing for the rest of their lives, instead of, as is right, these monsters being dispatched from this world with the greatest possible speed and efficiency. The idea is offensive to every normal human being, sense of natural justice. But the adoption of these proper penalties, necessary though it is, will be by no means dead with the totality of the problem. JT contends that society is today producing such unspeakable specimens in far greater numbers than ever before, is indicative also of a regressive genetic process that should cause even greater alarm than the softness with which they are dealt in the courts when they are caught and come to trial. It means simply that we are breeding more and more of the worst human refuse, just as we seem to be producing fewer and fewer people with the finest qualities of mind and character who are so urgently needed to provide the leadership required for the nation in all the many fields where it is lacking. Liberal dogma, JT states, forbids us on pain of the world's conceivable ostracism, including the attachment of the well-worn epithet Nazi, even to consider the introduction of a policy of genetic improvement as a means of bringing out the worst and procreating the best. strains in our population. But it is my honest opinion that if we are not prepared soon to stand up and defy the Liberals and accept the need for such a policy, the atrocities that make headlines in our newspapers now almost every week are going to increase without limit. JT goes on, I am not suggesting that we set about treating human beings as creatures to be cloned in laboratories. I advocate only that we strive to create, once again, the conditions for a healthy, uncontaminated and organic society where the best will tend to proliferate and the worst not to proliferate. In the ordinary natural course of affairs, though, the sensible and just provision of incentives and rewards at one end of the social scale and the correct imposition of penalties and deterrents on the other. JT reiterates, some readjustments of social welfare benefits will be a necessary part of this process. At the same time, I shall not shirk from proposing that there are elements in the population which, if not deprived of life themselves, should most certainly be deprived of the faculty and right to give life to future generations in whom criminal tendencies of the very lowest kind might be reproduced. As Britain has become more and more beset by social ills and tensions caused largely by the presence of great battalions of youth with time on their hands and nothing to do, an inevitable symptom of a laissez-faire way of life, there has been increasing talk amongst sociologists of the need for such youngsters to be organised in some form of community service. I could not agree more, JT writes, but it is important that in approaching such a question, we get our priorities right. In a previous chapter, we wrote about the need for young men to receive a period of military training. Supplementary to this, and possibly in combination with it, we could organise these young men to take part in great public work projects connected with the revival of these very run-down and depopulated regions of which I have been speaking. Indeed, the most suitable time to do this would be towards or at the end of their service in the armed forces, but while they were still members of those forces and subject to their disciplinary rules and subject to their duties. In such formations, they could then be sent to the areas in question, and possibly even overseas, to parts of the White Commonwealth, to provide a disciplined and organised labour force for schemes and development. A good rule of this service would be that every such young man should be obliged to undergo experience of tough manual work, irrespective of his social background or education, and thus come to understand the meaning of belonging to a true national community, undivided on grounds of class. One possible side benefit of introducing these young people to such underdeveloped regions is that they may be encouraged, when their service is over, to settle there. In that case, it will be helpful to provide them with special grants to do so. Indeed, this system of inducement, granted, proposals should be extended to all others desirous of such internal migration, provided, of course, that they met certain standards of qualification and character. A great many of our young people are, of course, already engaged in community work, but all too often it is of a kind from which the British race receives no benefit. Let those who feel it is doing good, in quotes, to perform services in Ethiopia, the Sudan, or the Congo, be told that it will be doing much more good to plant forests in Invernessshire, build roads in Gwynedd, or, if they want to go overseas, to bring water to the dry areas of Queensland or New South Wales. On the inner cities, JT writes, a lot of claptrap is talked about inner city revival and renewal. This usually envisages social solutions to be provided by the throwing of infinite money at the problem. The first truth to be recognised here is that a great many of the ills besetting our inner cities are the result of our importation into them of people by character, temperament and culture simply are not suited to that kind of environment. To state this is not to condemn the people themselves or to say that they are worse or better than we are, only that their proximity in our inner cities to the native British has led to tension and discord. The resettlement overseas of Britain's coloured ethnic minorities is an essential requirement of our task of inner city regeneration, if only because before any such regeneration is possible, those living in such areas must form united communities with a sense of common loyalty and identity. On architecture, JT writes, I have spoken of the insidious axis of political weakness and commercial power that has permitted the gross disfigurement of our urban centres. By extra senses of architecture that affront the human eye, but this does not wholly explain the phenomenon. Let it be admitted that our current fashions in building sculpture, music, painting, and other artistic fields have been arbitrarily determined by seemingly omnipotent cultural establishment to which it is allied. The modernist, in quotes, revolution, has too thoroughly succeeded in opposing its styles on society, despite most of the latter's dislike of those styles, for this to be explained as a normal and natural artistic development. Today, no new composer can hope to gain the fullest national acclaim unless his music consists of noise more appropriate to a metal worker's shop than to a concert hall. No painter can win recognition if his works bear any resemblance to the subject in question, and no major building will be commissioned which does not resemble a beer crate stood on its side. It is as if some strange power, far removed from any public or popular censure, has decreed that henceforth the creation of beauty, whether of sight, sound or thought, will be outlawed. Those creations of former ages will have to be tolerated for just as long as the Philistine masses want to keep them, but nothing of new age must bear their stamp. Art, music, literature, the theatre, and every other cultural medium must be placed at the service of the reigning modern orthodoxy and subjected to the will of its proprietors and promoters. Within the coming of the new Labour government of Mr. Blair, there are already signs of an intensification of this drive. Typically, the controllers of these new art forms turn truth on its head and insist that the hideous art world they have designed for us has been created in the name of freedom, and behind all resistance to it lie the dark intentions of totalitarians who would suppress the new spirit given the chance. In fact, JT points out, no such suppression would ever be needed in a natural order of things where artistic products were allowed to find their own level and where conventional taste was not rigged by those who controlled the main channels of communication on artistic matters. The modernists would soon find themselves out on the despised fringes of the art world, putting on their own exhibitions to their own tiny audiences of cranks, weirdos and cultural charlatans in their own galleries and paid for out of their own pockets. Just a comment here, I'm sure listeners are familiar with what John Tyndall is talking about regarding so-called modern art. A good example of this is the artist Tracy Emin. In 1998, she had an installation called My Bed. The description given by the Saatchi Gallery reads, Tracy Emin engages the viewer with her candid exploration of universal emotions. Tracy shows us her bed in all its embarrassing glory. Empty booze bottles, cigarette butts, stained sheets, worn panties, lovely. The bloody aftermath of a nervous breakdown. By presenting her bed as art, Tracy Emin shares her most personal space, revealing she is as insecure and imperfect as the rest of the world. The Telegraph reports £150,000 was paid by Saatchi to Emin for her infamous My Bed. It is now thought to be valued at well in excess of £1 million. And I recently read that the hypocritical Marxist Bono, the billionaire who doesn't pay any tax, he owns a piece of art by Tracy Emin. JT continues, for the fact is that the artistic totalitarianism of which the modernists are always speaking is of the very opposite kind to that which they allege. It is their own totalitarianism that is today making the running in the art world, consigning by the methods of intellectual intimidation all products of which they disapprove to the cultural wilderness, while their tight control of the mass media relegates everything classical and traditional to almost total obscurity but a simple method of ensuring that it is rarely mentioned. A prominent critic of this tendency, Professor Anthony O'Hare, writing in the Daily Mail on the 1st of December 1995, put it in a nutshell when he spoke of the painters and sculptors who wished to work in the great traditions of European art. But they form an underground movement, ignored and despised by the commissars of our artistic establishment. For, in the art world of today, as represented by the Turner Prize shortlist, which Tracy Emin has been on, modern does not mean art produced in 1995. It means art produced according to a particular agenda, an agenda which can only be described as decadent, a tendency of a once great culture to destroy itself from within. From the beginning, JT states, the left of politics has allied itself with this cult of degeneracy and ugliness, notwithstanding that the proletariat, in quotes, over which it is always fawning, is for the most part well capable of recognising its creations for the trash they are. Our revolution must be a revolution against contemporary modernism and back to classicalism. It must be a revolution which aims to recreate for our people an environment of harmony and beauty as expressed down the ages in the immortal soul of our race and through the labours of those who stand in the pantheon of European genius. The concrete junk that deforms our cities should be pulled down and replaced by spacious and noble designs which draw their inspiration from the Greco-Roman, Gothic, Baroque, Georgian, Victorian Neo-Gothic and other great and healthy traditions. Britain has not failed to produce the architectural talent necessary for the construction of noble cities, but we have failed again and again through municipal meanness and paucity of vision to give that talent its head. Wren, after the Great Fire, and Luton's, after the Blitz, each produced designs for a new London city centre that would have rendered it one of the greatest showpieces in Europe. But these imaginative concepts were both turned down. Today we have provincial cities with truly imposing buildings whose aspects is ruined by the erection of architectural eyesores in the immediate vicinity. It is time, JT concludes, to halt the mutilation of our urban landscape and give a chance to beauty, space and order once again. On cinema, JT points out that Britain possesses no film industry to call its own and has to rely on foreign finance, which in turn means they must have international appeal. We should regard our filmmaking talent as a national resource, JT asserts, to be publicly funded to whatever extent needed, while at the same time retaining its national identity. It will surely now be clear to the reader, JT writes, that running through this whole work is the belief that British society has degenerated and needs renewal of the most radical kind. We talk glibly of the preservation of our way of life, but how good a way of life is it really? Probably each person, when he speaks in those terms, is referring to some memory of an ordered world in which his own immediate vicinity and circle, when he mistakenly confuses with the pattern of society as a whole. Increasingly, this pattern has become one of disorder, and of a large portion of our people living their lives in a condition barely worthy, if worthy at all, of their ancestors. I have long been convinced that the liberal institutions and ideals to which we are given up today are inadequate to this task, JT goes on. It is a task that calls for our strength and wisdom of leadership that our prevailing system simply cannot produce. All the evidence of the past century proves this. The crisis demands a truly higher type of man, of the kind foreseen by Nietzsche, but rejected by most of his contemporaries and ours. In the dream of liberalism, the world of the future belongs to the ordinary man, and ordinariness has become our ideal in everything. Any political creed that aspires to goals above this level of comfortable mediocrity is immediately stigmatized as dangerous and its advocates as fanatics, whose voices should be silenced in the interest of public safety. We reject this entire worldview, JT states, based as it is on a contentment with the shoddy standards of a sick age, exhausted and we proclaim unashamedly our aim of leading our countrymen and women to an altogether high level of civilization. If that is dangerous and we are fanatics in pursuing it, then well and good. We are quite prepared to rejoice in such descriptions. If I am asked to define our ideal in a few words, JT continues, it is that of a noble race attaining the highest possible standards of character, health, strength and beauty, living in a land cleansed of disease, dirt, ugliness and degeneracy, and in complete harmony with the natural order. We want a nation of pride and honour, far above material ambitions, and surrounded by an environment of great art and culture which will provide continual nourishment for the national spirit. We are not world reformers as the liberals are. The itch to save mankind is absent from our armoury of ambitions and motives, because our common sense tells us that this is a goal that has eluded the most resourceful spirits across the centuries and will forever elude us. Our concern is to rescue our own particular section of mankind from degradation, aimlessness and chaos, and guide it to new peaks of quality and achievement. While liberals are forever international, we are essentially national. While liberals place infinite faith in social schemes, disregarding the importance of the human worth of those involved in them, we set as the first priority the improvement of quality of our people, without which no social schemes can succeed beyond the narrowest limits. Through the attainment of a higher man, we will build a higher civilization. That is the ideal for which we fight. That is the end of chapter 14. Next Sunday, we'll go through 15, which is entitled Racial Controversy. For anyone wondering, there's 20 chapters. And after that, I should hope to do some interviews on the White Network with some British nationalists and interesting people. Last year, there was a 20-year commemoration meeting to mark and remember the victory of Derek Beacon in 1993. It was held in London. I'll now play out with one of the speakers, who is a nationalist and a long-time friend of John Tyndall, whose name is Peter Rushton. So see you next week. Take care. 14 words.
It's a pleasure and honour to be here today as pretty much the only non-Londoner among the platform speakers, although in the late 80s, early 90s I was spending a lot of time in London, work and other reasons, and it was always a great joy at that time to be able to spend some time on nationalist politics in our capital, spend a bit of time at the bookshop, spend a bit of time on canvassing and leafleting on the estates of London, because you had the feeling that here was a nationalist politics that was going somewhere after the wilderness years of the 80s, the nationalist wilderness years of the 80s that I'd grown up through. Finally, at the end of the 80s, there was a serious nationalist politics that was going somewhere, especially in London. It was going somewhere against a background, let's not forget, of very intense opposition, as Dave touched on, very violent opposition that many of our people paid a heavy price in combating. Because, as one or two other 20th anniversaries have been mentioned, it was also 20 years ago, let's not forget, that the Harrods, the IRA's bombing of Harrods and later of Warrington took place. And that's highly relevant to the battles that we were fighting, because there was a direct connection, as we now know, and as is the more and more of the truth is emerging about this, there was a direct connection between the anti-fascist action that were fighting our people on the streets of London and putting out the eye of Michael Davidson, and the people that were planting bombs outside, certainly at Harrods. It was an anti-fascist action organiser that did that, and we're now beginning to find out, probably at Warrington as well, where two young boys were killed. That was the sort of scum that we were up against on the streets of London, and all credit to the brave activists of the BNP in London that they went out on the streets to fight the battle for the British people, knowing that they were taking on this violent scum that were prepared to put people's eyes out and were prepared to murder young children. That was the scum we were fighting then. That's the scum we're still fighting today. That's the scum that Derek Beacon and his brave allies defeated 20 years ago this month. And of course, there was another more polite sort of scum that we were up against. And they've got their reward. The people you remember on the island, the local vicar was in the forefront of the campaigns against us. The local vicar on the Isle of Dogs, he's got his reward. You know where he is now? He's not in the East End, surrounded by the consequences of his treachery. He's got his reward. He's the Bishop of Salisbury. He's in the cathedral close at Salisbury. That's the nice cushy job that the system looks after its own. The establishment looks after its own. But the real question that we as nationalists have to look at is, to begin with, how did we get there in 1993? Yes, there'd been those wilderness years that Frank touched on earlier on, the difficult years of the 80s when nationalism had been couldn't have been further away from the political mainstream. But the main reason why we won then and why we've won since and why we can win again, one of the main reasons, I think, is simply that we were telling the truth. We were telling the truth about a phenomenon that had already transformed Britain by 1993, especially transformed this area, as we've seen, and is continuing to transform it, namely mass immigration. Because contrary to the lies of the propagandists, contrary to the lies of the people who run the media and academia, and of course run mainstream politics, Britain simply was not, and has not been, Britain was not built up as a nation of immigrants. People, this is the great lie, that Britain was a nation of immigration. Britain was not a nation of mass immigration until the late 1940s. And the process that transformed Britain began in the late 1940s. The resistance to that process, the fight back to try to preserve the values of British nationalism, was rooted here in the East End. The pre-war nationalism of Oswald Mosley's British Union, later Union movement, had of course its great stronghold here in the East End. And quite possibly, if the electoral franchise for local government hadn't been quite as restricted as it was, the London County Council elections, the LCC elections before the war, might well have seen a British Union councillor elected here in the East End. This was where the British Union got its best results then. But after the various catastrophes that overtook every nation in Europe in the 1940s and certainly derailed any hope of British nationalism for quite some time. Again, here in London, in other parts of London, the original British National Party in the early 1960s, with John Bean, started to build a resistance to mass immigration, an electoral resistance. And it was partly the success of that movement and the gelling together of those of various nationalist factions. As has been mentioned earlier on, that's what the establishment is really afraid of. When various nationalist groups, people of various perspectives, various backgrounds, start to come together. All of that was starting to happen by the late 60s. The establishment responded by bringing in the first Race Act. And father of Tony Hancock, who many of you will know, the father of the late Tony Hancock, Alan Hancock, was one of the defendants in that first Race Act trial in Lewes, in Sussex, in 1967. Showing what can happen when people are brave enough to stand up and be counted, and showing that the establishment, even with all the power behind it, doesn't always win, that trial failed. because the 12 good men and true on the jury were not prepared to be bamboozled. The brainwashing hadn't proceeded sufficiently for that trial to succeed. And so the establishment then, as the NF grew through the 1970s, had to bring in a second, much tighter race act to make it very, very difficult for nationalists to defend themselves in the courts if the establishment came after them. And throughout and alongside that race act came the battles on the streets. Thought we're about to have another one a little bit earlier on. The battles on the streets of violent anti-fascism and the contrick of the Tory alternative, the contrick of Thatcherism. All those things coming together, all those multifaceted attacks, and even the brave patriots of the National Front, given the fact that, let's not forget, that also that the British electoral system, this is something we've got to mention in the context of this great victory of Derek Beacon's, compared to many parts of the world where nationalists have achieved success in elections, the electoral system in Britain, both the political culture and the mathematics of the electoral system, are very much against that type of breakthrough. It takes a lot of effort to break that system and actually to win a seat at any level in the British system. But when all of those things that were holding back nationalism in this country, through after 1979, the brave patriots of the NF hadn't managed to crack that electoral system until that moment. After 1979, with all these factors against them, all the splintering and the move into the wilderness happened. Now, this is the background to the rise of the BNP. That's the background to it in brief. Because throughout all of that period, and we still hear it today, there'd been, in effect, a dispute within an essential idea. I'm not talking about petty personal disputes, a debate, if you like, within our movement between two different responses, two different ways of going to try to overcome the political obstacles in our way. Some people said, oh, you'll never succeed as racial nationalists. You've got to trim your ideology to be closer to the mainstream. You've got to disguise what you believe in. You've got to move closer to the prevailing political ideology. Move closer to the Tories, in effect. Move closer to the political establishment. Other people said, no. So similar counsel of despair in a way, but taking them in an opposite direction, said, you'll never win with the political system. So the only way to go is on the streets and to build some sort of, it was never quite clear how this was going to be done, but to build some sort of revolutionary force on the streets. Now, it seems to me that the root of the BNP's success, the root cause of the BNP's success, is that those alternative siren songs, or to use an alternative Greek myth, that Scylla and Charybdis that had to be steered away from. Those two temptations were both resisted by the BNP. John Tyndall, after the chaos of the various splits of 1979-80, managed to, with great determination, with great intellectual force, and with great force of will, managed to build and hold together a movement through all of that chaos that by the end of the decade, because it took years to do it, by the end of the decade had managed to prove that a nationalist party could be both loyal to nationalist principles, which meant not only putting out bold propaganda addressing the immediate concerns of voters in places like Tower Hamlets, but meant when you were recruiting people, meant a commitment to political education, and meant a commitment to broader political issues and a broader ideological struggle as well. All of that, you could be loyal to nationalist principles, but at the same time, focused on practical politics. That being loyal to nationalist principles didn't mean going into an ivory tower and cutting yourself off from people's concerns. That was the root of the success of what happened here in Tower Hamlets, because by the end of the 1990s, whichever way different people had gone in the multi-splintering of the earlier, by the end of 1980, should I say, whichever way people had gone in the multi-splintering of the early 80s, the BNP was acting as a magnetic force pulling people together. Eddie Butler, who's been mentioned earlier on, being a very important example of that, because Eddie hadn't, of course, been in the BNP in the early 80s. He'd been with what was called the NF Flag Group, without going into all the details of all the different factions. But by the late 1980s, Eddie had seen that the BNP was the way to go and brought a significant group of people here in the East End with him. And the core of the Rights to Whites campaigns in the East End started to build up from the tail end of the 1980s. And then in the early 1990s, we had people from the other wing of the National Front, including Paul Ballard, John Merritt, and eventually Nick Griffin, coming in from the other sort of wing of the NF, because they similarly felt that the BNP was the way to go. Now, that coalescing of factions was a very important factor in Derek Beacon's victory, but also a very important factor was that Derek Beacon and his colleagues were telling the truth. I mentioned earlier on that telling the truth about the big picture of mass immigration. At the micro level here in Tower Hamlets, what that meant was telling the truth above all about housing policy. Because for all the great talk of the political establishment, all the great talk about the wonders of democracy, all the promises of Lib, Lab and Con, all the promises not least of having, you know, we won the war and all of this, that boiled down here in Tower Hamlets to the fact that local people couldn't rely on their children having a roof over their head. That's what it boiled down to here in Tower Hamlets. Housing was the key question. That people were seeing aliens from every corner of the globe moving in and having a house, having a roof over their head, but their own children couldn't get a place on a housing waiting list. That was the key issue in the election, and in the election the previous year that got the 20% for Barry Osborne. Since then, it's no secret, things haven't gone our way. Go into all of the reasons why, except to say that the objective factors, if you like, are still on our side. And don't think that because we've had very bad times, don't think that somehow the establishment are securely in charge. Don't think that our enemies are securely in charge, because we see only today just how shallow the establishment know that their success is. That it doesn't take very much for them to feel that the whole of their world could simply tip off its axis. Because we now know that in the revelations this weekend, in serialisation of a book by a Downing Street insider, Damien McBride, the ex-Labour chief spin doctor to Prime Minister Gordon Brown, that Gordon Brown has discussed deploying troops on Britain's streets as news of the 2008 financial crisis became clear. According to this book by McBride, Mr Brown said, "We'd have to think, do we have curfews? Do we put the army on the streets? How do we get order back?" He was quoted as saying, this is the Prime Minister, saying, if the banks are shutting their doors and the cash points aren't working and people go to Tesco and their cards aren't being accepted, the whole thing will just explode. If you can't buy food or petrol or medicine for your kids, people will just start breaking the windows and helping themselves. And as soon as people see that on TV, that's the end, because everyone will think, that's okay now, that's just what we all have to do. It'll be anarchy. That's what could happen tomorrow. And why could that happen tomorrow? Main reason is that that the establishment are faced with the consequence of the very destruction of communities, the consequence of the very destructive policies that we have been fighting against. That they, the political establishment, might have to pay the price for the fact that the white communities, which were better or worse, you know, all the mythology of the Blitz and all the rest of it, there's a lot of nonsense talked about the Second World War, but it remains true that white communities were able to withstand crisis of that type, just as they'd withstood economic crisis before, because people were prepared to help each other out, and because fundamentally people believed in the society that they were part of. They may have seen all sorts of things wrong with it and wanted to change all sorts of things, but there was, contrary to what Mrs. Thatcher was reported as saying, there was such a thing as society. There was such a thing as community. The very fact that the establishment have set out to destroy that ultimately is not necessarily a source of strength for them, but potentially a source of weakness, because that those bonds have been broken, those bonds aren't there. Those bonds aren't there to keep order once chaos begins. Once anarchy is let loose, those bonds are not there. However, at a deeper level, what we can tap on, what we can draw on, what we can tap, is the fact that at a deeper level, a memory, a folk memory of the fact that those bonds should be there, still exists. And that's why there's hope. Because every white voter knows the type of Britain, they may not admit it, they know the type of Britain that they want to have. And it's not the Britain that's out there that'll confront us on the way back to the tube. It's not the Britain they see around them, but they're aware that there is something better and should be something better. And it's that determination, that public feeling that we can do better, that there is an answer to international and domestic problems that is more sane, that has more potential justice than the political establishment is prepared to offer. It's that root wisdom of the British people that can carry us forward. I believe that there's a chance in this country still for a united nationalist party. It won't come soon. UKIP will continue to do well for the next 12 months or so, I'm sure. But both UKIP politics and EDL politics are in their different ways a blind alley. They're either going nowhere because of ideological vacuity, or they're going nowhere because simply marching around saying we don't want a mosque and then going for a pint afterwards simply isn't going to get anywhere. A nationalist party that learns the lessons that John Tyndall taught us all those years ago. A nationalist party that learns the lessons of Millwall Ward Tower Hamlets can still win. Can still win because, as Gordon Brown's response to the economic crisis of 2008 showed, the political system simply, the Lib Lab and Com system, simply isn't as strong as it pretends to be. Its roots aren't as strong as the party system was in the 1950s. Even with the present electoral system, the breakthrough is possible. With determination, with focus, with hard work, with dedication, we can do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, let's remember Derek Beacon's victory. Let's rededicate ourselves to coming together and fighting for the principles that he fought for, the principles that John Tyndall fought for, because it's those principles put into action that can rebuild London, even here, that can rebuild Britain, that can rebuild Europe. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.